is Wednesday, June 3rd, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Democratic Party candidates are projected to win the mayoral races in the key cities of Seoul and Busan. On News Briefing, we're breaking down the latest from the exit polls from KBS, SBS and NBC on the local elections. On In Depth, Chinese President Xi Jinping could visit North Korea as early as June 11th. We talk about what the visit could mean for China-North Korea ties, US-North Korea diplomacy and regional security. And on Korea Book Club, we introduce Swell by Son Bo-mi, a new English-language short story collection. Let's start Korea 24 right now.
(제9회) 전국 동시지방선거 시도지사 출구조사 결과 더불어민주당 11곳, 국민의힘 1곳에서 우세, 경합은 4곳으로 예측됐습니다.
다시 한번 말씀드립니다. 시도지사
Major broadcasters KBS, NBC and SBS released their joint exit poll results from the June 3rd local elections at 6pm as soon as voting wrapped up. The poll points to a decisive victory for the ruling Democratic Party. Of the 16 major mayoral and gubernatorial posts up for grabs, the ruling party is projected to win 11 seats. Of the 16, four battlegrounds are closely contested, while the main opposition People Power Party is projected to have won in one race, according to the exit poll. Held exactly 1 year after the presidential election, these local elections were the first major electoral test for the Lee Jae-myung administration. In total, 4,227 positions are being contested nationwide, along with 14 parliamentary seats in by-elections. For more on the elections and the exit poll, we have two guests joining us today in the studio. First, we have Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Alana.
We also have Seoul-based reporter Andrew Jung. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Well, let's begin with the biggest race. In-kyung, what is the projection for Seoul?
Their Democratic Party candidate, Jung Won-ho, is projected to win the Seoul mayoral race with 51.4% of the votes ahead of People Power Party candidate Oh Se-hoon with 46%. Jung and the DP campaigned on the ability to work closely with President Lee, capitalizing on the president's approval rating, which has hovered around 60%. The Democratic Party also framed the election as a judgment on what it called the insurrection party, referring to former President Yoon Suk-yeol's declaration of martial law. From the outset, the election was an uphill battle for the PPP. In local elections held early in a president's term, candidates from the ruling party have traditionally enjoyed a significant advantage. That pattern was evident in 2018 when the DP won 14 out of 17 major mayoral and gubernatorial races. It was also seen in 2022 when the PPP captured 12 of 17 major posts. This year, the PPP focused its campaign on inflation and housing prices, trying to convince voters to put a check on the governing camp. But that message appears to have fallen short against the home field advantage of the ruling party.
And In-kyung, tell us a bit more about those two candidates you just mentioned.
Sure. Jung served three terms as head of Seoul's Seongdong district. He defeated high-profile rivals in the Democratic Party primary, boosted by what was effectively an endorsement from President Lee. He received a lot of praise for his work in Seongdong, but not many people knew who he was on a national level. If he becomes Seoul mayor, he's expected to emerge as one of the Democratic Party's leading figures and a potential future national leader. For Oh Se-hoon, a victory would mark a fifth term as Seoul mayor, extending his record as the city's longest-serving mayor. Oh is seen as a moderate in the People Power Party. He openly put some distance between himself and the party leader Jang Dong-hyuk, who has been pushing to keep close ties with former President Yoon's supporters. If Oh loses the mayoral race, speculation is likely to grow that he could seek the PPP leadership as the party reassesses its direction following the election.
Well, let's turn to Busan now, the second largest city by population. Andrew, who came out on top according to the exit poll?
Chun Jae-soo, the Democratic Party candidate for the mayor of Busan, is projected to win the race according to the exit poll that we're going by. Chun Jae-soo had 50.2% of the vote, according to the poll. His lead over his main opponent, the incumbent conservative Busan mayor Park Kyung-jun of the People Power Party, stands at a very close 1.9% percentage points. Chun Jae-ju has campaigned on a promise to reverse the decline of the city by injecting dynamism back into the economy. His pledges have included attracting more jobs, increasing fiscal spending, and has mentioned Singapore and Shanghai as cities that he will seek to benchmark. Supporters have described the pledges as addressing the most urgent problems of the city. Busan's population has been declining, especially the portion of the young. So by bringing in more jobs and increasing spending, these supporters of Chun Jae-ju hope that the increased investments in the city will be a step in the right direction. His opponent, the conservative Park Hyung-jun, despite being the incumbent, has faced an uphill battle. Like many others in his party, his ratings have sagged along with that of his party, which has failed to redefine itself and has been continued to be seen as a party of insurrection. The former conservative president Yoon Suk-yeol was convicted of leading an armed insurrection when he sought to impose martial law in December 2024. Much of Park Hyung-jun's pledges have overlapped with his competitor, although he and Chun Jae-ju have disagreed on several major government-funded projects, which included a funding for a mega cultural arts center and the city opera house proposed by Park Hyung-jun.
And Andrew, could we have a few more details about the two leading candidates who are jockeying for that post of Busan mayor?
Chun Jae-ju, who's in the lead, according to the exit poll, is a former lawmaker who represented a district in the city. And he's also the former Minister of Oceans and Fisheries. So he has sought to capitalize on this resume, often referring to his past as the sole three-term liberal lawmaker from the city, which has tended to lean a little bit to the right. On his pledges to attract more jobs, he has said that as the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, he was the architect of many of the ministry's policies, which included bringing in two shipping companies, SK Shipping and H-Line Shipping, to the city from Seoul. So if Chun Jae-ju wins, the victory will mark a political revival of sorts, because he was previously accused, and very recently accused, of accepting bribes from the Unification Church worth thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. So the charges against him were dropped in April by prosecutors who cited a lack of evidence, which also triggered outrage from Chun's political opponents, who said that the charges appeared to have been very conveniently dropped just before the campaigning period began. Park Hyung-jun, his opponent, is a journalist turned academic turned politician. So he went to Korea University. After that, he was a reporter for the Daily here, Chungang Ilbo. He then went to academia, where he taught at Dongha University in his hometown of Busan. He entered politics as an advisor to the conservatives in the 1990s, then entered parliament in 2004, representing a district in the city as well. He also served in the Lee Myung-bak administration as a political and PR advisor. So if he manages to a major come-from-behind win, that will be a huge victory for not only for himself, but also for his very, so far, unpopular party.
We're going to talk Daegu now, where pre-election polls had shown a neck-and-neck race between the two candidates. In-young, what are the exit polls telling us?
The exit poll still projects an extremely tight race between the DP's Kim Boo-geum with 49.1% and the PPP's Choo Kyung-ho with 49.9%. They're both political heavyweights. Kim is a former prime minister, while Choo served as deputy prime minister. Daegu was one of the most closely watched contests of this election. The city is traditionally a conservative stronghold, but it became unexpectedly competitive, riding on President Lee's victory last year. At the same time, the People Power Party was in complete disarray early on over who should be its candidate. But the PPP gained momentum after the ruling party proposed a special counsel bill last month that could potentially allow the withdrawal of indictments linked to President Lee.
And In-young, why was this race considered just so important?
Well, Daegu has long been one of the most reliable conservative voting blocs in South Korea. Think of it as the Texas of South Korea. If the Democratic Party succeeds in winning Daegu, it'd be a historic breakthrough in a region where progressives have traditionally struggled to get a foothold. It would also be a huge vote of confidence for the Lee administration and a sign that the party's appeal is expanding into new territory. On the other hand, if the People Power Party holds on to the city, it would provide an important boost to the conservative camp following last year's presidential defeats and the impeachment of former President Yoon after his martial law declaration. It would demonstrate that the party remains competitive in its traditional strongholds and could serve as a foundation for rebuilding ahead of future national elections.
Well, polls also predicted a tight race for governor of North Jeolla province. Andrew, how are the projections shaping up there?
The Democratic Party candidate candidate for the governor of the province, Ewontek, appears to have the upper hand, according to the exit poll. Ewontek had the support of 48.5% of the votes, with, again, a very close 2.2% lead over his main opponent, the incumbent and independent candidate, Kim Kwan-young.
Well, listeners, especially maybe those outside South Korea, might not be super familiar with those candidates. Andrew, could you walk us through exactly who they are?
Ewontek, who's in the lead, is a lifelong politician. He has served as a staff member at the governor's office, which he is running for today, the mayor's office in Jeonju, the province's main city, and later to President Moon Jae-in before he entered parliament, where he has now served a two-term lawmaker. If he wins, the Democratic Party will likely breathe a huge sigh of relief because the province has and remains as a province that is a must-win area for the Democratic Party in any major election because it is almost never lost in the region. Ewontek has sought to harness his status as a governing party candidate who can work with the popular President Lee Jae-myung to curry administrative favors and enlarge funding from the central government for his province should he be elected. His main opponent, the incumbent governor, Kim Kwan-young, had sought to play up his credentials as the governor, pointing to his claims that he had attracted billions of dollars worth of investment during his term. His potential defeat could mark a low point for his political for the political moderate because he has been, during his 15 years as a politician, he has been a centrist who has swung between conservative and liberal parties.
Well, before we move on, Ingyun, can you explain how exactly this exit poll was conducted?
Sure. The exit poll was conducted from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. today, serving almost 109,000 voters as they left 615 designated polling stations across 16 cities and provinces nationwide. The exit poll also incorporated the results of a survey conducted over 4 days from Saturday to Tuesday on 11,357 eligible voters who took part in early voting. The margin of error is estimated between plus or minus 1.7 and plus or minus 4.1 percentage points at a 95% confidence level. The poll was carried out by three research agencies, Ipsos Korea, Korea Research International, and Hanguk Research.
Well, let's now take a step back and look at the bigger picture. Of the 16 major mayoral and gubernatorial elections, Ingyun, how many races are the DP and PPP projected to each win?
The Democratic Party is projected to win 11 races, while the People Power Party is expected to secure one seat. The remaining four races remain too close to call. Well, the numbers show the DP locking down Seoul, Incheon, Jeonnam, Gwangju, Daejeon, Ulsan, Sejong, Gyeonggi, North Chungcheong, South Chungcheong, South Gyeongsang, and Jeju. The PPP looks set to take just South Gyeongsang province. The results aren't surprising because local elections held roughly within a year after a new president takes office have almost always favored the ruling party. The DP is expected to take the results as a clear public mandate, basically a green light for President Lee to push forward with his agenda. It'll mean smoother coordination between his office and the National Assembly on passing laws and getting budgets approved. Looking inside the parties, DP chief Jeong Chung-nae is expected to have a major advantage heading into the next party convention on the condition that the DP wins in North Cholla. On the flip side, PPP leader Jang Dong-hyuk is likely to face intense pressure over responsibility for the defeat and questions about his political future.
And Andrew, based on the exit poll, how do you think the ruling DP and the main opposition PPP might be viewing the results?
The governing Democratic Party started out the campaign with huge advantages. The party had an overwhelming lead over its main rival, the PPP. President Lee Jae-myung's approval rating was stably above 60% for the last several months and most of this year. Paradoxically, the minimum bar that the Democratic Party had to achieve was very high. It was around 11 or 12 or 13 maybe. So the expectation being high, they had to win decisively, which as of now appears to be looking to be the case. On the other hand, for the Conservative People Power Party, because it was at such a low, the party's approval ratings were hovering near a dismal 20%, plus or minus 2 to 3 points. The party's leader, he has been seen widely as possibly a far right or someone very close to it. Again, never a great asset for winning elections. Again, paradoxically, the expectation was low. I think maybe a month ago, there had been concerns that the party could lose every major region. So winning four could be called a not such a bad result, despite that still being a very poor showing, losing 12 out of 16 major races is never good in any election anywhere. And another barometer I think we should look at is, you know, who wins the city of Seoul? It's, again, a hugely symbolic city. It has 9 million people. It accounts for a fifth of the country's GDP. And the office holders of the mayor of Seoul has gone on to bigger offices. So whoever wins that office has huge symbolism, regardless of what happens in the broader race. But here again, we see that the Democratic Party candidate is in the lead. Again, this is according to exit polls. So, you know, things might change. But as of now, the Democratic Party appears to have achieved or met its expectation.
And public interest in this election was particularly high, given that 14 National Assembly by-elections were also held simultaneously, accounting for nearly 5% of the total parliamentary seats. Two of the most watched races were Busan Bukgap and Pyeongtaek Ul. Tell us about the race in Busan.
Sure. Busan Bukgap was a brutal three-way battleground. It pitted the DP's Ha Jung-woo, formerly President Lee's chief aide for AI policy, handpicked to run by the DP chief, the PPP's Bang Min-sik, a former veterans minister, and independent Han Dong-hun, a former justice minister and leader of the PPP, who was pushed out by current leader Chang Dong-hyuk. So it was a race between the candidates, but also a race between Han and Chang. The exit poll projects the DP's Ha and independent Han in a tight race with 42.6% for Ha and 41.6% for Han.
And Andrew, what's the projection for Pyeongtaek Ul?
Cho Guk, the liberal and rebuilding Korea Party candidate running for that district, is projected to win according to the exit poll, having won the support of 31.1% of voters. He had a tiny 0.5% lead over his closest competitor, the conservative Yoo Hee-dong from the People Power Party, according to the poll. That district covers a large swath of the city, the Pyeongtaek city, that is, including parts of the port, the U.S. military base known as Camp Humphreys, although, of course, the Americans on that base won't be voting, and most importantly, where some of Samsung's chip factories are. The race was, as was the case in Busan, was neck and neck to the end with the latest publicly available polls before the election showing the three top candidates, Kim Yong-nam of the Democratic Party, the conservative Yoo Hee-dong of the People Power Party, and Cho Guk, all scoring in the 20% range and within the margins of error. So that's why Cho Guk is leading, despite only having 31.1% of the vote, according to the exit poll.
So some really tight races there. Well, before we wrap up, Andrew, when exactly are we going to get the final official ballot count results?
The vote count begins at 6:20. The earliest counts will become publicly available at around 7:30, but it will likely take hours before we have some indication of who is the likely winner in each district. In closely contested districts, like the Pyeongtaek Ul district that we just talked about, results may become available as late as 3 or 4 a.m. the next day. The count is also likely to take longer than previous years because of a new rule that mandates electoral officials to do a hand count after the votes are tallied by a machine. There was also a hiccup at a polling station in Seoul's Songpa district in the afternoon today, adding to concerns about the delayed vote count. Starting at 1 p.m., shortages of ballot papers were reported in that district, with voting stopping entirely at some stations by 4:30 p.m. The National Election Commission said it had moved quickly to address the shortage and said that voters who were delayed by the shortage, again, of ballot papers, which the commission said was caused by a higher than expected turnout, could vote past the 6 p.m. deadline.
Well, ballot counting is still underway, but we'll report the official election results in detail and provide an in-depth analysis on our show tomorrow. That's all we have for today's news briefing. Thank you so much, In-kyung.
Thank you, Alana.
And thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Claudia Cardenas, Taekwondo world medalist from Ecuador and founder of Himchari Dojang. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
In In other headlines of the day, the US announced on Monday local time plans to temporarily reduce tariffs on select metal products. Our KBS World Radio News editor, Daniel Che, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other news. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, can you give us the latest on this welcome move that's expected to benefit Korean firms?
Sure thing. The White House announced on Monday local time that Trump signed a proclamation adjusting tariffs on imports of steel, aluminum and copper under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act. So it says tariffs on agricultural equipment such as combines and harvesters as well as some other equipment will be reduced from 25% to 15%. Meanwhile, the existing category of industrial equipment subject to 15% tariff has been expanded to include mobile industrial equipment like bulldozers and forklifts when imported from trading partners that are entitled to such treatment. And that includes, of course, South Korea.
Now, did the South Korean government give an estimate of potential benefits that Seoul will enjoy following this change?
Yes, the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy in Seoul believes the export items are expected to benefit from the move. It will be worth some $2.3 billion. The government also vowed to communicate closely with related industries to review the details and the related impact as well. The tariff reduction will take effect June 8th and remain in place until the end of 2027.
Well, staying with economy-related news, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has raised South Korea's economic growth outlook for 2026. Daniel, give us a breakdown of those figures.
On Wednesday, the OECD released the revised outlook, raised by 0.9 percentage point to 2.6% for this year, citing the country's robust chip exports. Quite the turnaround from back in March when the organization slashed its growth outlook for Korea by 0.4 percentage point to 1.7%. Back then, they cited rising concerns about the Iran war.
So the chip sector is largely responsible for prompting the OECD to raise its growth outlook for South Korea. Just how big of an impact does the industry have on the nation's economy?
Well, South Korea's semiconductor exports surged more than 169% on year to an all-time monthly high of $37.2 billion last month. Outbound shipments surged 53% from a year earlier to a new monthly high of $87.8 billion in May on the back of the semiconductor supercycle. The OECD believes the country's outbound shipments of chips will continue driving the nation's economic growth amid the global AI boom.
Let's now turn to some updates on the deadly explosion at a Hanwha Aerospace plant. Daniel, give us the latest.
According to the Daejeon Metropolitan Police on Wednesday, the National Forensic Service identified all five victims of the Hanwha Aerospace plant explosion in Daejeon that occurred earlier this week by matching their DNAs using genetic samples from family members. The victims' remains have been handed over to the bereaved families.
And Daniel, what about the cause of this explosion? Do we have any more details on the findings by investigators?
Earlier, Hanwha Aerospace said the workers were in the process of cleaning gunpowder residue off of equipment at the time of the explosion on Monday, during which two people were also injured. On Tuesday, a joint on-site inspection by the police, fire authorities, forensic experts and the Labor Ministry found that the facility that handled explosives was only equipped with a 20-kilogram fire extinguisher and did not have sprinklers.
Shifting the spotlight now to the diplomatic realm, there's growing speculation that Chinese President Xi Jinping could visit North Korea this month as the two sides mark the 65th anniversary of their friendship treaty. What's the latest on that front?
South Korea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said Tuesday that it's closely monitoring whether Chinese President Xi Jinping will visit North Korea. Earlier observations suggested the visit could happen between late May and early June, but analysts said it was difficult to pin down exactly due to various Chinese diplomatic schedules. Some observers believe Xi will make the visit around next Thursday as it marks the 65th anniversary of the signing of the China-North Korea Treaty of Friendship, Cooperation and Mutual Assistance, the only such defense pact China has with any nation.
Any particular signs the government spotted that lends weight to the Chinese leader's visit?
According to diplomatic circles, a potential visit by President Xi to North Korea would require prior logistical preparations such as increasing flight frequencies or upgrading aircraft to accommodate a large entourage and equipment. As such, officials in Seoul have been paying attention to recent changes in Chinese flights to the north. Flag carrier Air China has deployed larger Airbus A330 planes for its regular flights between Beijing and Pyongyang and added cargo planes to its roster.
And what are we hearing from various foreign media outlets regarding the possible visit and other related signs that have been detected?
Over in the U.S., Time magazine reported last month, citing anonymous sources, that she will make a visit to North Korea soon. NK News, an independent media outlet specializing in North Korea, reported this week that a large structure believed to be a viewing platform was installed in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square.
Well, we are going to delve more into Xi's potential visit to North Korea later in our in-depth segment, so do stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, that wraps up today's news briefing. Thank you so much, Daniel, for bringing us the headlines.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is reportedly considering a visit to North Korea as early as June 11th, according to South Korean media reports citing government sources. Such a visit, if it comes to fruition, would be Xi's first journey abroad this year and his first visit to Pyongyang in 7 years, and would follow summits with US President Donald Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin in recent weeks. South Korea's presidential office said it is monitoring related movements, adding that it expects China to play a constructive role in issues related to the Korean Peninsula. To discuss what Xi's potential trip could mean, we're joined today on the line by Dean Cheng, a non-resident senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. Great to have you with us today, Mr. Cheng.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with the timing. Recent satellite imagery analysis suggests that North Korea may be preparing for a high-level foreign visit. It notes that Pyongyang International Airport appears to have cleared space for a foreign aircraft fleet. This is similar to preparations seen before visits by the leaders of China and Russia. Imagery also shows construction in Kim Il-sung Square, where temporary gazebos have been used in the past to welcome ceremonies for foreign leaders. Mr. Cheng, what's your read on the timing of Xi Jinping's potential visit? Why now?
Well, I think Xi Jinping is trying to send a political message, right or wrong, that China is the centerpiece. China is the keystone country. Major leaders either come to China, President Trump, Russian leader Putin, or that Xi is going to be a key part of major cockpits of potential conflict like North Korea. So I think that fitting all of these together is a way of reinforcing this message globally. China matters. China is important. Nothing happens without Chinese say-so, or at least Chinese participation.
Mm-hmm. Well, building on that, beyond the question of timing, there's also the question of what Xi would hope to achieve from such a visit. What do you think could be the purpose of a potential trip to Pyongyang?
I think it's important to recognize that from the Russian perspective, Russia's closest partner at this point is not China. Mm. Russia's closest partner is North Korea. North Korea is the country that is willing to send munitions and even its own troops to go fight alongside Russian forces in Ukraine. The problem here is that there has long been competition between Russia and China dating back to the 19th century for influence over the Korean Peninsula. So I think Xi Jinping's visit is an effort to basically signal to Pyongyang, no matter how good your ties are with Russia, understand China is a very important partner and arguably the more important partner than Russia is.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you more about Russia's potential influence in all this. But before that, and beyond the symbolism of the visit itself, many are focused on what role Xi could play in the broader diplomatic picture, because this possible trip comes shortly, of course, after his summit with President Trump in Beijing. During this trip, the two leaders reaffirmed their commitment to the denuclearization of North Korea. Some observers have speculated that Xi could seek to facilitate renewed dialogue between Washington and Pyongyang. What's your assessment of that possibility?
When we look at the readouts from both the American and Chinese side from the summit, the denuclearization aspect is one of the few points where both sides agreed, but there were so many points where either one side or the other would emphasize something and the other side would say nothing at all or would even contradict it, that I find it unlikely that Xi is now going to commit too many political points on behalf of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. The other thing to consider here is that denuclearizing North Korea really has not been a Chinese priority. They pay a lot of rhetoric to it, but they have not been willing, for example, to sustain sanctions and the like. And again, going back to the Russia-China competition, Russia, by comparison, has actually argued that North Korea has a right to defend itself against aggression, including potential nuclear weapons capacity, and has ended really any pretense of sanctions on North Korea. So for China to be pushing North Korea, whether to have a summit with Trump or closer ties or even a reduction in hostilities, is something that really would involve a lot of political points that China probably does not want to spend on behalf of the U.S. with North Korea.
And coming back to Russia and the broader regional alignment to consider, Xi's potential visit, of course, also follows a visit to Beijing by Vladimir Putin, during which the two leaders agreed to further strengthen their strategic coordination and deepen good neighborly and friendly cooperation. It also comes as North Korea and Russia continue to deepen their military, political and economic cooperation. What do you think Xi's potential visit could mean for trilateral ties between China, North Korea and Russia?
I think North Korea continues to be a focus of competition, not cooperation, between Russia and China. And so I think that Xi's visit, again, is meant partly to signal to both Moscow and to Pyongyang, China's interests, China's concerns about North Korea need to be taken into account. And again, when we look at the Russia-China summit, Putin and Xi, on the one hand, signed a whole raft of agreements, but perhaps the most important issue, that of a pipeline to run Russian natural gas to China, there was nothing that came out of this summit. And So I think, again, you have a lot of rhetoric, a lot of flowery images, and a lot less concrete positiveness.
Now, China has traditionally been North Korea's most important economic partner, but Russia, you know, as I just mentioned, has emerged as a much more prominent player in recent years. Do you think perhaps Beijing is concerned about losing influence in Pyongyang?
Absolutely. I think that it is very concerning from Beijing's perspective that Russia is supplying arms, parts to North Korea, supplying energy, all of the things that used to almost entirely come from China since the mid-1990s. Now Russia is providing. Why does North Korea have to take Chinese interests into concern if Russia can meet all of its needs?
Mm-hmm. Well, economic issues are likely to be high on the agenda. What kinds of economic cooperation or assistance might North Korea be seeking from China at this stage?
I think everything from greater investment in North Korea to economic assistance, perhaps development along the border, the port area up in the northeast where Russia, China, and North Korea all come together. But above all, for North Korea is going to be energy requirements, consumer goods to keep the population fairly happy, and food.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you now about how Seoul might be looking at this potential summit. South Korea's presidential office says it's watching related developments and hopes China will play a constructive role on Korean Peninsula issues. What should South Korea be paying closest attention to if Xi does visit North Korea?
Well, I think President Lee needs to recognize that despite his natural desires for better relations with North Korea, it should not obscure the reality that the PRC is not a catalyst for improving North-South Korean ties. China does not get much from a unified Korea that reaches to the Yalu. So from the South Korean perspective, the most important thing is whether or not China provides renewed military assistance to North Korea, followed by energy, which would allow the North Korean military to do more training. But the other thing to keep in mind here is that China has demonstrated very little willingness to pressure North Korea to reduce tensions, to stand down its military, to redirect its massive military spending towards domestic and therefore more peaceful uses. So I would not be optimistic about anything emerging from a Xi visit that would improve North-South ties.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Cheng, before we look forward, I want to actually take a moment to look back. Xi Jinping last visited North Korea in 2019. Of course, this was before the pandemic, before the dramatic expansion of ties between Pyongyang and Moscow. How have the strategic calculations of China and North Korea changed since then?
In 2019, North Korea really was isolated. It depended very much on China for energy. And of course, if you look at that famous photograph from space of Northeast Asia at night, you have the lights of China, the lights of South Korea, the lights of Japan, and the utter darkness of North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in the intervening 7 years, there are more lights that are on, but that's thanks to Russian energy, not thanks to Chinese energy.
Finally, Mr. Cheng, if Xi's visit does go ahead, it does take place, what specific signals should observers be looking for? Are there particular agreements or joint statements or even public appearances that could potentially reveal the true purpose of this trip if it does go ahead?
Obviously, we should keep an eye out for things like renewed economic agreements. If the Chinese decide that they are going to invest in North Korea, which would be certainly intriguing, or if there are any signs of a Chinese attitude like Russia's that basically says denuclearization really is even less important from a rhetoric perspective. All of these would be major fundamental shifts. But I don't think that's likely to happen so much as signing some agreements that are going to be about friendship and cooperation and low-level investment and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. But we'll continue to follow developments surrounding President Xi's potential visit to North Korea and what it could mean for regional diplomacy and security here on the Korean Peninsula. Dean Cheng, non-resident senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
Hello everybody, my name is B-Boy Phil Wizard and I am the Breaking Gold Medalist from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Because it is election day, the markets are closed, so we don't have our regular KOSPI update. But we are joined now in the studio by Natalie Kwan for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, Alana.
Natalie, let's jump right in. What's our first story today?
Team Korea has one last match before the FIFA World Cup. Now, if you'll remember, they just snagged that 5-0 victory against Trinidad and Tobago on Saturday, mm-hmm. and they're hoping to keep that winning momentum ahead of Wednesday's match with El Salvador.
Right, we did talk about that amazing 5-0 win over Trinidad and Tobago, so I'm sure confidence levels are high. This really is Korea's final chance to fine-tune things before the World Cup gets underway. What can we expect from El Salvador?
Well, El Salvador is ranked 100th. And Korea is ranked 25th. So I don't want to get ahead of myself, but we'll see how the competition goes. Korea's win against Trinidad and Tobago was smooth thanks to a strong offensive. However, Korea's defense remains untested since Trinidad and Tobago didn't really get much of a chance to try getting past it. We'll see if El Salvador is able to give us a better sense of Korea's defense. The team is traveling to Guadalajara, Mexico on Friday, where they'll stay for the first two group stage matches in the World Cup.
Right. Don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but of course, we'll be keeping our fingers crossed for another win. Is there anything else we should look out for in the match against El Salvador?
Well, actually, Team Korea has already sustained a few injuries, so that puts some changes into the team. We'll see how that affects their momentum. But their goal in this match against El Salvador is really to keep that momentum going. Their first match will be against the Czech Republic on June 12th.
Right, so while the result will matter, of course, keeping the squad healthy and building momentum ahead of the World Cup may be just as important. Let's move on now to our next story. What are we going to be talking about?
Taekwondo. In Rome this week, the 2026 World Taekwondo and World Para Taekwondo Grand Prix will be taking place. That will be in Rome between Thursday and Sunday.
Sounds really exciting. For our listeners who maybe aren't familiar, what exactly is the World Taekwondo Grand Prix?
Good question. It's just a premier international competition for Taekwondo athletes. So there will be about 255 athletes from 52 countries there, including a team of refugee athletes. Meanwhile, the Para Grand Prix Taekwondo competition will have about 111 athletes from 29 countries. The competition format has athletes going against each other in hand-to-hand combat, although this year will also feature a virtual Taekwondo side competition, where athletes will compete via virtual reality.
Really interesting. So it's not just traditional Taekwondo, but also, you know, a real chance to see how this sport is evolving. What about the Korean athletes taking part? Who should listeners be watching?
There will be quite a few Korean athletes at this year's competition. Notably, Seol Eun-soo will be competing. He was the most valuable player of the 2025 Wuxi World Taekwondo Championships in China. There will also be Park Tae-jun of Kyung University, who was gold medalist in the same weight category at the 2024 Paris Olympics. Also, Kang Sung-hyun from the Ulsan Sports Council and Kim Yoo-jin from the Ulsan Sports Council. They both won at Wuxi, and Kim Yoo-jin also won gold at the Paris Olympics in 2024.
So in addition to all these Korean athletes, Natalie, is there anything else special about this year's competition?
Well, interestingly, the Grand Prix this year is marking the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Italian Taekwondo Federation. So there's been some performances, and there will be more festivities on the opening night in Rome, and again at the closing ceremony on the 7th.
So sounds like it'll be a big event both on and off the mat, and we'll certainly be watching to see how those Korean athletes perform. Let's wrap things up now with our final story of the day.
Right. Are you a BTS fan?
Yes, I would say I'm a part of the army.
Okay. Well, the much-awaited BTS concert in Busan is taking place on June 12th and 13th. Apparently, accommodations are selling out really quickly. Several hotels in the city have already reported dramatically increased bookings, some even at full occupancy for the 3 days surrounding the concert.
I can't say I'm surprised, but, you know, Busan is already a super popular summer destination. But is this level of demand unusual even by Busan standards?
It is unusually high. The BTS concert, it's not really a typical music event, but more like a citywide tourism occasion. Concert goers are expected to take part in other parts of Busan's tourism industry, so think tours, museums, food, the fish market. But what's really notable about the tourism surge we're seeing there, according to industry experts, is the level of individual type bookings. Now, usually when overseas tourists come to Busan, they tend to book in groups, but these days, because of the concert, lots of fans are opting for individual bookings.
Well, hopefully all the fans heading to Busan for that concert really enjoy themselves. That's all that we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Natalie, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you.
It's It's time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. And in the studio with us today is Julia Ratti, a translator from Korean into Italian and English. Julia, hello and welcome back.
Hello, Alana. I'm so happy to be back. And I also have a funny story to share with you before we talk about our book club choice today.
Okay, tell me more, Julia.
So you might remember that last time I was here, I introduced Teddy Bears Never Die by Cho Yeon, mm-hmm. translated by Song Yoon. It's the story of Hwayoung, a high school girl who picks up a discarded teddy bear from the side of the road, only to find out that it's sentient. And together they go up against the city's mayor and evil ghost to avenge the death of Hwayoung's mother. Anyway. I'm saying this because as I was walking back home after the recording with you, I found a Winnie the Pooh plushie by the side of the road. So I picked it up. And it's home now, washed and dry. And I can fortunately say that unlike the teddy bear in the book, this one isn't walking around the house wielding an axe.
Well, I have to say, I would have been so genuinely spooked out by that. But I'm very relieved to hear that this Winnie the Pooh is behaving himself and not reenacting the novel in your home, Julia.
Yeah.
Okay, after that slightly haunted coincidence, tell us and all our listeners, what book are you introducing to us today?
So today is the turn for Swell by Son Bo-mi. The Korean title of Swell is quite different. It's Kudorege Lindy Habul, literally Give Them the Lindy Hop, published back in 2013 by Munhak Dongne. This collection of 9 short stories has been translated by Janet Hong, and it's out on June 9 by Tuland Press. I really hope this will be the start of more of Son Bo-mi's work into English. She's such an intriguing author.
Sounds like a really exciting release, and it's always interesting, I think, when a short story collection becomes the first major introduction of a writer to English language readers, because I think it really gives us a broader sense of their range. And so before we get into the stories themselves, let's first talk a bit more about the author herself, Son Bo-mi.
So Son Bo-mi is a South Korean writer who was born in 1980 in Seoul and whose first publication is the short story Blanket, for which she received the Dongha-Ilbo New Writers Award in 2011. So you can see that her career spans a good 15 years. Up until now, she has won no less than 7 awards, including the Young Writer Award 4 years in a row from 2012 to 2015, the 2017 Daesan Literature Award for Fiction, and 2 Lee Hye-suk Literature Awards, one in 2024 and one in 2025, which is kind of amazing.
Absolutely.
And her long list of publications includes 3 short story collections, 3 or 4 novels, an essay collection, and more. And yeah, it's easy to conclude that she's a very prolific writer.
Very prolific and clearly very decorated. 4 Young Writer Awards in a row, it's no small feat. And the fact that she's still winning major prizes more than a decade later says a lot about her staying power. Before we get into Swell, have you read any other of Son Bo-mi's other work?
Oh yeah, actually I have, and our listeners can too. So for example, we have a translation by Jamie Chang, the Hot Air Balloon in 2014 for Asia Publishers. And then I know that the translator of Swell, Janet Hong, has been pitching Son Bo-mi for quite some time. So, for example, The Cat Thief is available on Literary Hub. And then we ran a feature on KLN, Korean Literature Now, in the fall issue of 2024 with the story The Substitute Teacher, a review on Son Bo-mi's work, and an interview between the author and her translator, Janet. So all of this can be found online. It's not behind a paywall. And basically just this can be your little appetizer before Swell.
That's great. So there's already a few entry points for readers who want to get a taste of her work before Swell comes out. Yeah. And it sounds like Janet Hong has really been championing Son Bo-mi for a while, which is, you know, always lovely to hear from a translator. Let's get into the collection itself now. What can you tell us about Swell?
Well, Swell is Sun Bo-mi's first full collection out in English, which is kind of a big deal since the short story collections are usually kind of ignored in the English market. Interestingly, the title of the collection doesn't come from one of the short stories. The way I see it, Swell references the way Sun stories begin from a very small point in the daily life of their characters and then become bigger, like they swell or they balloon, up until they lose stability and the bond, the connection that keeps them together, loosens and disappears, creating this sense of confusion and curiosity that accompanies all her stories.
That's a really interesting way to think about the title, not as one specific story, but as a kind of movement or feeling across the whole collection. Julie, can you explain what you mean by sense of confusion and curiosity?
Sure. I think the key to understanding Sun Bo-mi's work is that she explores the psyche of her characters, the memory and love also in its most fragile forms. And to maintain this fragility, she never overexplains. Her style lacks blunt revelations and favors instead emotional shifts and fragments of memories and depicts how our choices quietly shape the trajectories of our lives, taking us to where we are now. So in this sense, Sun's work features a psychological suspense that suits the short story format better than the longer format of the novel, for example. And in fact, what I really find engaging in Sun's work is that the words she creates seem more plausible due to this sense of confusion, which leaves space for the reader's own interpretation and makes us long to know more. Sun also said a similar thing in her interview for KLN. She said that for her, all fiction is fundamentally a detective story that moves forward, not because of the plot, but because of readers' curiosity, because of readers' desire to know which choices the characters will make.
I really like that idea that the suspense comes less from what happened and more from why did this person make that choice or what are they not saying? It sounds like the stories really ask readers to pay attention to the quiet things, the small decisions or half-remembered moments or kind of those emotional gaps. And maybe that's why the short story format works so well. You're given just enough to feel unsettled, but not so much that kind of everything is neatly explained.
Exactly.
Julia, what else can you tell us about this collection?
Well, I'd like to explore the stories a little bit, not too much, but along with Sun's trademark ambiguity, the collection revolves around a handful of themes. For example, the first three stories, Blanket, Downpour and Silence, deal with class disparity. In Downpour, we have a very clear contrast of this disparity when the stories of a working-class family and the professor's family intertwine. The professor's wife mistakenly believes that her husband is having an affair with the other family's woman on the night their house catches on fire. And then the third story, Silence, also deals with a struggling couple. The husband is a relapsed alcoholic, while the wife keeps them afloat by translated subtitles for Japanese porn movies. The central character here is the wife, who watches on as her husband spirals back into addiction, and she later decides to break up with him. Silence is quite unusual in Sun's work because the viewpoint is that of the female character.
That was Julia Ratti introducing us to Swell by Sun Bo-mi, translated by Janet Hong. Julia, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, and see you soon with another book recommendation.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us, and until tomorrow, take care and goodbye.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometres per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programmes while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you start off on your journey. If you receive a message or call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.
KBS World Radio.